Should a minister run for president? That's an interesting question, isn't it? There are many who say no, ministers shouldn't, that they have the ministerial hat on and you can't wear two hats at the same time, and they shouldn't run for president. So I'd like to ask a series of questions that neatly cluster around. Can begin to think through the important issues of how what we believe relates to the country and the body politic in which we live. So the first question is, should a minister run for president? And I would subdivide this into two questions. Should a minister be involved in politics? And unless you, and in case you're inclined to say no to that, let me remind you that Martin Luther King was a minister, and I've found very few people who have suggested that Martin Luther King should not have been involved in political issues. We've immortalized him, made monuments, named streets after him, have a national holiday after him. Martin Luther King was a minister. Martin Luther King was a Baptist minister. Martin Luther King was actively engaged in politics, and we have made him one of our national heroes, one of the handful of people after whom we have a national holiday. So in case you're inclined to think that Pat Robertson shouldn't run for president because he's a minister, just remember that Martin Luther King was a minister as well. Also, during the Vietnam War, when people were at least, say what you want about what they were saying, when they were at least morally involved rather than socially indifferent, there were many ministers actively involved saying, we need peace, we need morality in our foreign policy, we need to express ourselves in the body politic. And I heard very, very few people objecting that ministers were being involved in politics during the Vietnam War. Also, we've had priests in Congress, and I hear very few people who are objecting to Pat Robertson running for president, also objecting to the fact that we've had priests who've been members of the Congress of the United States. During the abolition days, ministers were very much involved in getting rid of the institution of slavery in the United States. In fact, were it not for ministers and were it not for Christians who saw this as immoral and unconstitutional, perhaps there would have been no overturning of the dread slavery in our country. So my answer to the question, should ministers be engaged in politics, is yes. Martin Luther King was. Many were during the Vietnam War. We've had priests in Congress, and many ministers were involved in the abolition movement. But should a minister run for president? That's a slightly different question, because that's the highest office of the land, because that's a little more visible and a little more important than somebody taking a march down the street. Well, if you're inclined to say Pat Robertson should not run for president because he's a minister, let me ask you this. Jesse Jackson did. Were you opposed to Jesse Jackson running for president? Why is it that a black minister can run for president but not a white minister? Why is it that a liberal minister can run for president but not a conservative minister? Why is it that a Democratic minister can run for president but not a Republican minister? What's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. Should a minister run for president? Jesse Jackson did, and there's no reason why Pat Robertson shouldn't. This raises another interesting question. Should we legislate morality? Don't we have here, however, a minister who wants to legislate his moral position? Isn't he opposed to abortion and opposed to homosexuals and opposed to drunkenness, and isn't he going to legislate his moral agenda? And doesn't that make it, because it's such an influential position, wrong for a minister to do? Isn't prohibition a classic example of where legislating morality is wrong? Haven't we learned our lesson? Are we returning to the same kind of situation we were in before? Interesting questions, right? But before you assume that we should not legislate morality, let me ask you a series of questions. Civil rights was legislating morality. Was that wrong? Is it wrong to legislate civil rights? Open housing was legislating morality. Was it wrong to legislate open housing? Is it not morally right for someone to live where he wants to live, to work where he wants to work, is it not right for every citizen of the United States to vote and to have their right protected by law? Anti-discrimination laws are legislating morality. It's morally wrong to discriminate against somebody because of race, creed, or color. It's not wrong to legislate morality. Child abuse laws are moral laws. Would you like to live in a country where it was right to abuse children? Would you like to live in a country where it was permitted by law to rape, to have incestual relationships, or to murder? In fact, if you think about it for a moment, almost all good laws are legislating morality. And I think that we need to reconsider this old adage that says we should never legislate morality because we should always legislate morality. You have two choices, legislate morality or legislate immorality. And if we're not going to legislate morality, we're going to legislate immorality. And I think that we ought to legislate morality. Civil rights was, open housing was, fair employment was, anti-discrimination laws are, child abuse laws, rape, incest, and murder, and a whole host of laws are legislating morality. In fact, let me quote from Mark Twain. This is a rare book by Mark Twain called Christian Science, written in 1907. Here's what Mark Twain said in his day, and it applies today. Quote, in their private life, speaking to politicians, they are true to every obligation of honor. Yet in every session, they violate them all and do it without shame, because honor to party is above honor themselves. By vote, they do wrongful things every day in the party interest, which they could not be persuaded to do in private life. In the interest of party expediency, they give solemn pledges, they make solemn compacts. In the interest of party expediency, they repudiate them without a blush. They would not dream of committing these strange crimes in private life. Mark Twain is bemoaning the fact that there were many fine Christians in the country who had beautiful private ethics. When they got into public office, they threw aside their private ethic. In other words, he goes on to say, there are Christian private morals, but there are no Christian public morals at the polls or in Congress or anywhere else except here and there and scattered around like lost comets in the solar system. Now, when I was pondering these words, Twain hit my solar plexus with another one. Quote, his Christianity is of no use to him and has no influence upon him when he is acting in a public capacity. He has sound and sturdy private morals, but he has no public ones. I'm with Mark Twain. I think what we need more, not less, is people who will legislate morality. Should Pat Robertson run for president? Well, you can't eliminate it because he's a minister. Otherwise, you'd have to eliminate political involvement of people like Martin Luther King or Jesse Jackson. Should we legislate morality? Does he have a right to legislate his moral agenda, to do everything in his power to push that through Congress? Certainly does, because it's not only a right, it's an obligation to legislate morality. The only other choice is to legislate immorality. What about prohibition? Prohibition was over-legislating morality. Prohibition was legislating the wrong morality. Prohibition was legislating total abstinence. That's unrealistic in a fallen world to legislate total abstinence. I believe it's the best private policy for a Christian to voluntarily adopt. But you can't legislate total abstinence. All you can legislate is temperance. You can legislate a temperate society. You can get rid of drunk drivers, mad, sad, all right. But you can't legislate total abstinence. So prohibition is not a good example. In fact, prohibition is a bad example. The good examples are civil rights and open housing and fair employment and rape and incest and murder. These we must legislate, as we must legislate against homosexual practices that will contaminate our society and that will destroy us. Last report I saw, for example, said that there are now 100 million cases of AIDS in the world. 100 million. It doubles every year in the United States. It started at 12,000, 24,000, 50,000, 100,000. We're going up not mathematically, but arithmetically, astronomically. We need to legislate morality. problem. Whose morality are we going to legislate? That's a very important question. Historically, you know how that was answered? Historically, it was answered, we will legislate the Judeo-Christian morality, because the Judeo-Christian morality is the morality of our founding fathers and the basic morality of the masses of our people. There was a Judeo-Christian consensus, and we legislated Judeo-Christian morality. That is not to say that we legislated Judeo-Christian religions. The First Amendment prohibits establishing religion, but we did legislate the moral principles. So here's how I would suggest the answer to that question. We must allow private rights as long as they don't infringe on others' rights or corrupt society. For example, I would allow smoking, but not polluting the air of others. There ought to be laws that permit people to smoke, but do not permit them to blow it in our faces. There ought to be laws that allow drinking, but laws against drunk driving. Because while a person has the right to drink, he does not have the right to infringe on my right to live while he drinks. We ought to have laws that allow mining, but laws against raping the environment. We ought to have laws that allow private rights, but that protect human life. We ought to have laws that allow women's liberation, but not at the expense of killing tiny human beings who happen to be housed in their womb. In other words, protect private rights as long as they do not infringe upon the public rights. But yes, let's by all means legislate morality. That's what kind of society we want. Third question that comes to mind as I think of the question, should Pat Robertson run for president, is should we impose our religion on other people? Isn't it true that Pat Robertson has a unique religious point of view that the press calls fundamentalist, that he would probably call evangelical and charismatic? And isn't he the type of person who wants to express his religious views in his political life and therefore would be violating the separation of church and state? Well, let me separate this question, should we impose our religion on others, into a couple of questions. One, should we be able to freely proselytize? Should we be able to freely make converts of others in our society? You know, there are people who would so separate church and state that you couldn't really evangelize. I've been in countries like that. I've been in Poland, where you can't evangelize on the streets of Poland. So the Christians just sing as they walk around their testimony. I would like to suggest that in spite of the growth of Hare Krishna, Unification Church, Mormons, and all kinds of sects in our country, that we want to maintain a country in which it is right for cults to freely proselytize, and because the freedom of expressing one's religion is inherent in the very nature of that religion itself. So I want to have a law that protects the rights of Hare Krishnas to proselytize. I don't want to kick them out of public places because I want to pass out tracts there too. And if they happen to be more zealous and more devout so that they're at the airport more often than we are, shame on us who have the gospel, the unsearchable riches of Christ to give to an impoverished world, and we're letting them do it. They are utilizing a right that is there and ought to be there. We can and should freely proselytize, even though it will permit cults to do it. I'm not afraid. You know why? I'm not afraid of the truth in the open marketplace. I believe in the free market of ideas. And I believe the truth will always come to the top, just as the best product will come to the top. People will ultimately find out what it is. And we shall know the truth, and the truth shall set us free. So we have nothing to fear from permitting freedom of religion, even if the religion happens to be a cult that's proselytizing, or a little church down the road from us that happens to be a revival of ancient pagan and Greek mythology. But the real question here, when we ask should we impose our religion on others, is should we separate church and state? Shouldn't we keep the two domains? Won't it be impossible for someone like Pat Robertson, who has had a religious hat so permanently affixed to his head that it'll be almost impossible to take this off and put on a political hat. Shouldn't we really, at least symbolically here at the highest office, separate church and state? To which I ask you to recall a little bit of your government class. What does the First Amendment say? In case you forgot or didn't memorize it, I happened to bring a copy along. Reads this way: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Now, the important phrase there, or the first part of that, has an important series of words. There are really two for our purposes: Congress and establishment. Notice the word separation doesn't occur in the First Amendment. That is a myth that is commonly perpetrated. There is a country in the world that does have the word separation in its so-called First Amendment. Let me read it to you. The country name begins with U.S. In order to ensure to citizens freedom of conscience, the church in the USSR is separated from the state and the school from the church. Freedom of religious worship and freedom of anti-religious propaganda is recognized for all citizens. Article 124 of the Soviet Constitution. Now, notice the American First Amendment had nothing to say about separation of church and state. That's a myth. The Soviet Constitution does have something to say about church and state. Let's read the American one again and exegete it. First word, Congress. That refers to the national government. Was talking about the national government shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. The national government cannot establish one church for all the people. After all, we just come from a place that did that. That's why we were here to begin with. And Thanksgiving reminds us of the pilgrims who came here because they didn't want the repression that was under a state church that imposed itself upon the people and did not allow divergence of opinion. So they were opposed to the Congress or federal government establishing a church. Now, when this First Amendment was put in, there were 13 states. 8 of the 13 states had their own individual state religions. They weren't opposed to even state religions. They were opposed to national religion. If you wanted this religion, go to this state. If you want that religion, go to that state. If you want to have a choice, you can go to that state. You know, we've got Rhode Island and other states. But 8 of the 13 states had their own state religions, so they weren't opposed to uniting church and state, and they weren't for separation. You say, but Thomas Jefferson referred to a wall of separation. He gave it in his speech to the Baptists. Thomas Jefferson, in his wall of separation statement, was not referring to a wall between the church and the state. Let's suppose that this is the church, this is the state, and we'll get a hymnal here, and make this the federal government. So if this is the federal government, and this is the state, and this is the church, the humanists would give you to believe that the wall of separation here should be between the church and the state. That's not what Jefferson meant. Jefferson had a wall, but it was here, between the federal government and the states. And then the humanists took this wall of separation and they moved it over here and gave us the impression that there's a wall between the church and the state. That's not what Jefferson meant. The wall is right here between the federal government and the states. And it wasn't until the Everson case in the 1940s that actually that was effectively moved over here and applied to the states as well as the church. So constitutionally, we are not obligated to separate church and state. And in actuality, I think it's an impractical thing to do. The key word is establishment. Here's what I would suggest. Establishment of religion by the state, no. Encouragement of religion by the state, yes. Let's analyze that. There's no reason why the state should not encourage religion. In fact, if you read the First Amendment, there are two clauses. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. That you hear a lot. You know, the ACL pushes that. But how about the next one? Or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. It's called the free exercise clause. And the free exercise clause, to me, implies that the state should encourage religion. One way it encourages is right here. It's giving us tax deductions. You go to some countries, I've been to Australia, New Zealand, some countries, you don't get tax deductions for contributions to your church. That certainly isn't encouraging religion. And if you look at the statistics in a country like Australia where you don't get tax deductible contributions to your church, you'll find that probably only 10% of the people and gifts that we have in churches and to churches here exist there as existing in the United States. So establishment, no. Encouragement, yes. Total separation, no. Neutrality, yes. You can't have total separation of church and state. That's impossible. It's practically impossible to coexist in the same society. But at least you could have the federal government being neutral toward particular religions, not favoring one religion over another. That's what establishment means. Establishment, no. Encouragement, yes. Total separation, no. Total neutrality, yes. Another distinction I'd like to make is freedom from religion, no. Freedom of religion, yes. We ought to have a country in which there is total freedom of religion. Every religion, pagan religions, idolatrous religions, cultic religions, everybody ought to be free. But no establishment of religion in this country any more than there should be freedom from religion. Now that leads me to a fourth question. Should religion be taught in the schools? This has been a very perplexing question, especially because one of the purposes for which public schools were originally started was to teach children to read the Bible. That's one of the original purposes. Now, we've come a long way from that because in our public schools we can't even read the Bible anymore, but at least we recognize it as part of our heritage. Now, I want to ask this question. Is there any legitimate place in a society such as ours where we don't want to engage in the establishment of one religion? Well, we can nevertheless permit freedom of religion in the public schools. And I'd like to note several ways in which I think this is possible. One, teaching about religion, yes. Teaching of religion, no. That is, the public school should not be engaged in the teaching of religion in any compulsory way. I don't want, for example, my children subject to the teaching of the religion of Buddhism or Hinduism or humanism. I don't think that classes ought to be obligated in a compulsory way to listen to teaching of religion. On the other hand, I do want children exposed to the teaching about religion. They ought to know about Buddhists and about Hindus and about Muslims and about Mormons. This is a pluralistic society. It's a real world in which we live, and consequently the teaching about religion is not unconstitutional. In fact, I testified in a famous trial called the Bristol Bible Trial in Bristol, Tennessee, in which the judge ruled that it is not unconstitutional to engage in teaching about religion. As long as you do it objectively and do not appeal to people and say, this is true, you must believe it, as long as you teach about them objectively, there's no reason why you can't teach the Bible in the public schools. In fact, that was what they were really concerned with, the teaching of the Bible. They were teaching the Bible objectively, and the court ruled that you can teach that the Bible says this. What you cannot say is you must believe this, or this is true, or you should worship this God. But you can tell every story in the Bible in a public school. You can tell every story just as it is and say, this is what they believe. This is what some Christians still believe today. You can even say, this is how Christians believe you ought to be saved and go through the four spiritual laws. But if you say to them, you ought to be saved, or I believe you ought to be saved, or this is true and the others are false, that, of course, would be the teaching of religion. But you can teach about religion in the public schools. Secondly, as I would like to suggest, release time teaching of religion. Not only should we not have compulsory teaching of religion, but we ought to have voluntary teaching of religion on a release time basis. There's no reason why we can't use the buildings and have release time for the children to come. And if you're evangelical and you want them taught an evangelical approach and somebody's liberal or somebody's Buddhist, fine, let every church have their representative to do their thing. There's no reason why we can't have child evangelists there and have a class for people who want to come to that class. I'd be happy to see religion competing alongside of religion in the marketplace of truth. I don't fear truth. What I fear is monopoly, where only one point of view is taught. So yes, teaching of religion on a release time basis. Well, how about prayer in the schools? And here I'd like to distinguish three different levels. First of all, state-prescribed prayers, where the state writes out the prayer and passes it out, and the school as a whole is prescribed to pray that. I'd say, no, I don't want state-prescribed prayers. I don't want any state religion. That smacks of a state establishing religion when the state prescribes the prayer and asks everybody to pray it. How about non-state prescribed prayers that are nevertheless compulsory for everybody? Where, let's say, the teacher prescribes it or the local school board prescribes it and everybody stands every morning and prays. I'd say no to that. I'll tell you why. I don't want to have a school board that's dominated by Buddhists or Hindus or Muslims or secular humanists prescribing prayers that are contrary to my convictions or contrary to the Word of God and forcing my children to be exposed to those every day. So I don't want state-prescribed prayers. I don't want compulsory prayers. This is a society where we have to respect minority rights. It's all right when we're in the majority, but how about when you get in a city where you're in the minority and becomes a different thing? But thirdly, voluntary prayers in the public schools, yes. There's no reason in the world why we shouldn't pray in the public. There's no reason in the world why a class shouldn't pray. If everybody doesn't want to pray, then they can be excused. That happens for everything. It happens for physical education classes. It happens for all kinds of idiosyncratic things in our culture. There's no reason why just one or two in a minority have to keep the majority from doing it. That is really a tyranny of the minority, to exclude any kind of religious influence in the public schools. Voluntary prayers, even on a mass or class basis in the public school, are not a violation of the constitutional rights. I mean, it's terrible when in order to do something in the public school that sounds religious, we'd have to reach in our pocket and get a coin and read it, "In God We Trust." That's about all you can do. Now, or else pledge allegiance to the flag or sing one of the patriotic songs, the national anthem, that has some religious phrase in it, or read the Declaration of Independence. We've come so far that some of those things are considered illegal by some people, and that's way too far. Here's my suggestion for the solution to the public school dilemma. And we've got a problem. The recent Tennessee case certainly depicted that, where parents said, "I don't want my children taught secular humanism." The judge ruled that you don't have to have your children taught secular humanism in the public school. That's a violation of your religious rights. And that's one of the first cases we've won, and that's why the media picked it up and made such a big deal about it. But here's a solution. What do you do in a society where you have people really believe X and really people who really believe that X is not true and other people who believe Y and people believe Z? And everybody wants their view taught. I think in a pluralistic society like that in which we live, the fairest system of all is a voucher system. The fairest system of all is a voucher system where our tax dollars are distributed instead of paid to the local school board, they're paid to the parents who can send their children where they want, if they want to send them to a private school or to this public school or that public school, but where the voucher system enables everybody to send their children to the school which teaches what they want according to their beliefs. Now, the reason it's fair is because the response in Tennessee to the Christians who won this case by the other side was this: well, you have a choice. You can educate your children at home or you can send them to a private school. But you see, that's not a choice for poor people. That's only a choice for rich people. So the voucher system would enable the poor to have an alternative to the secularized public school system as well as the rich. Right now, only the rich have an alternative because they can afford to send their children to private schools, but the average poor person cannot afford to do that. By the way, footnote, in the providence of God, he has built into the system a release mechanism for that. The poorest people of all, the minority groups that live in ghettos, totally ignore the Supreme Court. Most of them don't even know what the Supreme Court said. You go to the average black school in the ghetto in any city, they pray and read the Bible and never have stopped doing it. And the ACLU will never do anything about it either. I can guarantee you that they won't do anything about it. They never heard of separation church and state. They probably, many of them didn't hear the First Amendment, even let alone being willing to practice it. So yes, we ought to have religion in the school.